did you say anything yesterday on Monday about the
Karenist factor?
No. Oh, actually, that's it. No. Okay. The other thing is about the errors in the Wikipedia on history
and
sociology.
No, because we didn't discuss that.
Okay, well, let me make I'll make an announcement right at the beginning. Okay? Okay, first of all, I want to point out a lecture. I think I mentioned this last week or maybe a couple of weeks ago. Next week, next Monday, right, the 25th of February, there are going to be two lectures on this campus, and you can't attend both of them at once. You have to choose one or the other. And they're quite opposite in terms of what they're going to talk about. But they're, you know, either of them is well worth attending, and they are relevant to the course. The first one is by the author John Cornwell, where he is going to deal with Richard Dawkins' view about basically religious instruction at home being a form of child abuse, and saying why that's wrong, and then wondering, in converse, what we should be doing about atheism in society today, whether atheism is a problem in society today, okay? And that is sponsored by the chaplaincy here, and I'm not sure exactly where that's going to take place. My guess is either in the chaplain's building or in the art center. But the other lecture takes things in an opposite direction, and this is by a neuropsychiatrist, Gary Lynch, from the United States, who's going to speak. Both of these things start at 5:30 on Monday. He's going to be speaking at the main lecture theater of the medical school, which is on the South Campus, right? You go down Gibbet Hill Road, and you know there's this place where a lot of biology and medical school instruction takes place. He's going to talk about enhancement, okay? Cognitive enhancement. In other words, in terms of his own research, the way in which particular drugs can be used to boost our minds and to get us into another kind of mental space that in some sense transcends the normal limitations that we have as human beings. And then talking more generally about the issue about whether it makes sense to think about science as being on this trajectory towards taking us out of Homo sapiens, as we normally understand it, into some sort of post-human species, right? Where drugs, as it were, is just the beginning of this, but then we might talk about genetic manipulation and so forth down the line, okay? Both of these lectures, I think, will be well worth attending. They both start at 5:30 on Monday. They're on opposite sides of the campus. You couldn't even go back and forth between them if you wanted to. But I hope you attend one or the other of them. That's one announcement. The second one has to do with something that Elizabeth brought up to me last week. You know, Elizabeth is doing a PhD that has to do with the status of sociology in this country and what sociologists in particular think about the profession and where it's going. I have provided some links to you in my last email to the history of sociology from Wikipedia. And some of the stuff in that article is fine. I hadn't looked at the stuff about Britain, but the stuff about Britain is wrong. And she pointed this out. It made it look like there had been no professors of sociology in this country until after World War II. In fact, it's true that the vast majority of professorships only happened after World War II, so that sociology was a very minor discipline in this country prior to that point. But in fact, as I've mentioned in this course, the London School of Economics established the first chair in 1907, and this was an interesting chair because this was a case where the people endowing this chair in this new discipline of sociology had to decide whether sociology was going to be biologically based or not, because the person in Britain who primarily used the word sociology was Herbert Spencer, right? He's the one who introduced the term into the English language in the 19th century. And for people living at the turn of the last century, the word sociology suggested Spencer's project, okay? And so there were three candidates for this chair, two of whom were biologically oriented. In other words, they were inclined to think about human societies as kind of a complex extension of animal societies and part of a common sort of evolutionary trajectory, right? That is to say, no God, no special privilege for human beings, but rather kind of continuum. We can talk about human intelligence and animal intelligence, and human intelligence may in fact be much greater, but it's much greater by degree, not by kind. So it's not that humans have a special capacity that differs from animals, but rather humans think in a better fashion than animals do, but animals think in the same way as well, only they don't think quite as well as we do, but in the same way. So, in principle, one could measure animal intelligence and human intelligence. Now, two of the three candidates had this kind of perspective. They lost. The person who got the chair, Hobhouse, I think I've mentioned him here in the course, he is the first chair of sociology in this country. He's a philosopher by training and comes from the sort of secular Protestant Oxford movement that was quite prominent at the university at the end of the 19th century. And Hobhouse established this kind of precedent that we see throughout the history of sociology in the 20th century in this country, which you even see in something like Anthony Giddens's New Rules for the Sociological Method, Anthony Giddens' first major book, 1976, where there's this kind of demarcation between what biology covers, which is the prehistory of humanity, the stuff that doesn't change historically, genes, whatever, and history, which is the changing stuff. And sociology is about the changing stuff, about the stuff that changes in historical time. And historical time being understood as a much smaller period of time, right? So in Hobhouse's day, it was often thought that the major civilizations started like 4,000 BC, okay, so only 6,000 years ago. Whereas, of course, they already were thinking about the fact, as a result of Darwin's work, that the history of life on Earth extends millions of years. Okay, so the prehistory is very long and very deep, but the history is kind of short and malleable. And it's that short and malleable part at the end that sociology deals with, right? This isn't, and I think that if you look at most of your sociology textbooks, that this is the reason why biology tends to be downplayed or treated as a kind of social construction, is because there's this presumption that insofar as biology matters at all, right, it's part of some deep kind of past that you really cannot change through social means. Okay? And this was the precedent that was established by Hobhouse's appointment to this chair in 1907. Now, as I've been alluding to in this course, our knowledge of biology has massively increased over the course of the 20th century. We now have a much greater grasp of genetics in particular, which is something that people really didn't have a clue about in the beginning of the 20th century. We really understand genetics well. We are understanding better how genetics is connected to particular socially relevant traits. We understand the molecular biology of this. We've sequenced the human genome now. So in other words, we can intervene at much finer grained levels to see what happens when you mess around with people's genetic makeup to see what becomes of them. So the fact that our genome reflects something that was constructed over billions of years, let's say, doesn't mean that we can't change it radically overnight. Okay? This is the point, right? The fact that something has a long prehistory doesn't necessarily mean we can't change it quickly, if we know what we're doing. And the point about the 20th century in the history of biology is, in a sense, we know more and more about what we're doing. I mean, if you look at the end of World War II, for example, okay, so the end of World War II, we're talking about 1945, you got a lot of biologists back then, so they know something about genetics. They know how genetics works, but they don't yet know the molecular biology behind genetics because DNA hadn't yet been identified. That happens in 53. So in 1945, you get a lot of geneticists saying, well, the way you want to make the species advance is by irradiating people. Because one of the things you know about, so you think about nuclear bombs and stuff, right? So, just bomb people. People think, okay, bomb, and, you they die, right? This is what happened in Japan. Okay, but if they don't die, their genes will mutate. And of course, any kind of difference or progress that takes place in evolution comes about initially through the mutation of the gene pool. So whatever can mutate genes quickly and effectively is potentially something that advances evolution. So you actually have a lot of geneticists making this argument that nuclear radiation may be good for you. It may expedite evolution. Now, this was all being said before we understood the molecular biology behind genes. So the point here is we're not saying that anymore, just to be clear. We're not saying you should be nuclear irradiating yourself and that nuclear bombs are a good way of advancing progress, okay? But the point is, that's what they were saying even 50 years ago. Now we don't say such things, but we can do things in a much more precise, fine-grained level, actually looking at the particular gene we're targeting, and we know already that this gene is the gene that's responsible for certain kinds of traits. Okay? And the problem, of course, is, and this is the problem that still remains, it hasn't gone away, is that the really socially relevant traits, you know, the kinds of things you study about in sociology that you're concerned about somehow dealing with, the things that can cause social problems, for example. So, for example, this business you may be reading about in Bridge End, where all these kids are committing suicide, right? What, is there a gene for suicide? I don't think so, not in any kind of straightforward way, right? But it is possible that there may be some combination of various genes, and there are thousands of them to contend with, that in some combination might make people prone to this. That may be true, but that's not going to be easily found. And in any case, it's not going to be just by identifying one gene that somehow you turn off. Okay? So the point here is there may be genetic explanations for a lot of these rather complex sociological issues, and this may be the kind of thing that in this century people will have more of a grip on, okay? But we don't yet, okay? And so, but we're moving along in that direction. And I think that's the thing that, you know, in a way, what's the take-home lesson of all this stuff about, you know, sociology and biology is that we are actually moving down this trajectory where, in a sense, the biological is becoming increasingly incorporated into our conceptions of the social. And it's not because of some ideology being imposed on us, it's because of developments within biological science that then makes its way into medicine, into policy, okay, and gives us a kind of more sophisticated understanding of the causes, you know, the underlying causes of the sort of things that we consider to be socially relevant. Okay? So that's kind of the movement there. Now people resist this for all kinds of reasons, and it's understandable why they would resist it. Okay? But I think the thing that you always have to keep in the back of your mind, and this is something that I hope in this century will be made very clear, is that to say that something is biological is not to say that it's determined. Okay, because when we talk about, you know, the reason why people don't like the kind of biological viewpoint is because we're imagining if it's biological, then you can't change it. And that's indeed kind of the way in which this distinction tends to have been cashed out within sociology. And that's why the whole business about our biological past being this kind of deep history of genetics that can't change because it's been put there for millions of years, right? That's where that, you know, so that idea gives you this impression that you end up saying, well, actually, that's in our genes and it's been there from the time we were reptiles or something, right? That you can't be able to change that very easily. Okay, but that's just false, right? No matter how many millions or billions of years a gene has been persistent across life forms on the planet, it does not follow that you cannot change it. You can change it, right? I mean, it's not obvious that you know all the consequences of the changes. It's not, you know, I mean, and that's the problem, right? Sure, you can change it, but what happens then? Okay. And that's the thing that we're getting to know more and more as we study biology more closely. So the point here is that you shouldn't associate biological with deterministic. Now, this has another consequence, and I'm raising all this now because I do think this is, you know, if you're thinking about where is sociology going to go in the future, and why am I talking about these kinds of things? I think this is actually where we're going to go. Think about it from the standpoint of trials in courts, okay? There was a time when if you could show that something was biologically determined, like you had a gene, some strange gene, right, that could excuse you. Because in some sense, you weren't in control of yourself. You didn't realize you had this genetic thing that kind of made you do this. Okay? But now things are changing. Okay? And as genetics becomes part of a normal understanding of people's, you know, physical well-being, kind of thing that maybe a doctor would tell you about, or maybe in the future the government might require that you know your genome. Okay? I mean, we're worried about the identity card problem in this country. But there's another side of this issue, and that is the rights and perhaps obligations of people to know about their genetic makeup for medical purposes. Insurance companies are very interested in this, right? Because, you know, at the moment, the way insurance companies figure out whether you're at risk is by you talking about your behavior, right? Do you smoke? Are you obese? Right? All this kind of stuff that's kind of on the surface. But of course, if they start to require, actually, I don't want to know what you're doing. I want to know what your potential is. Like, do you have some genes there lurking around that might, you know, end your life tomorrow, but you haven't yet experienced because they just kick in when you turn 50 or something? You see, so insurance companies are pushing for this, right? That in a sense, people should be told. They should, first of all, get a genomic scan, you know, like a barcode scan when you go out to the checkout counter, right? And that the insurance companies need to have access to this information in order to determine what kind of risk you are. Okay? Now what this means is we move to, and this may well happen. I mean, you know, people are resisting this for various reasons now. Part of it being the science isn't precise, right? We still have problems with the science. But let's say we go down this route. One of the consequences of this is going to be you're going to be responsible for your genetics. In other words, it's not that the genetics determine you so you couldn't help what you were doing. But rather, you should know what your genetics are to keep out of trouble. Right? Because if you know that you've got some kind of propensity for something that's in your genes, then don't do the thing that's likely to trigger it. It's your obligation. See, so the whole idea of requiring people to know their genetic makeup, you know, that kind of, open access, make it known to people, force people to know these things, make it part of general education, what it does then is incorporates it into your decision-making capacity and makes it then a free thing, not a determined thing. Okay? And there was a very important case in the United States where this was tested. This has to do with the Eskimos, you know, the Inuit people, as they're called in a politically correct way, but they're normally known as Eskimos. You know, they live out there in the igloos and so forth. Okay, in Alaska. And these people are quite a relatively self-contained population, so as you can imagine, they have very particular genetic things going on there. These people have a gene that makes them, what we would say, alcohol intolerant. Okay? So in other words, they get drunk real easily. Okay? Now, how should this affect traffic codes in Alaska? Okay? What do you think about it, right? I mean, so you think, okay, you know, you say beyond a certain point of alcohol content in your blood, right, you're over the limit and, you know, you get points on your license and so forth. But what if you've got this genetic disposition and you know you've got it, because the thing about the Eskimo population is it's a protected population, as often these kinds of groups are, right? So in other words, they have special medical care, medical treatment, because they have these very particular kinds of medical conditions. And this is all provided by the government and so forth. So it is to be normally expected these people would actually know they have this. Okay? But what if they drink over the limit anyway? You know, they get into a crash and start trouble and all the rest of it. Okay? Well, the judge was faced with this case where the lawyer, the defense lawyer, was arguing, but this alcohol intolerance thing, this Eskimo guy had no control over it. It's just in his genes. You can't put him in jail for this. Okay? And the judge said, sorry, this guy he knew about it. And he did it anyway. Okay? And this set up, courts have been very reluctant to follow this. I'm not saying this is like law of the land stuff, but there's a precedent. future. And my guess is there'll be more and more cases like that, right, where the genetic aspects will be incorporated into what is part of your social makeup, so that you're taken to be responsible for that just as much as you're responsible for anything else you might do voluntarily. Because you should know, you know, that you've got these genes, that, you know, this is going to happen. Okay? So the point here is that the business about the relation between sociology and biology is one that's been under continual negotiation. In the case of Britain and most of the countries, when the discipline gets established, it's largely by distinguishing sociology from biology, making a sort of line between the prehistoric and the historic. So it happens in 1907 in Britain. It happens in other countries much earlier. Britain's a relative latecomer. Okay? But that distinction remains pretty much intact until maybe the last decade, where people are reopening the questions more and more. Okay? And so it is entirely likely that the, you know, like, think about this. The biggest growth area in sociology today, and I've mentioned this before in the class, is in the health areas. Okay? In terms of course numbers, in terms of hirings, and so forth, it's health. Now, that's, you know, that's the biological interface of sociology. Okay? So we kind of already see this happening. But it's not the old style biology of determinism. It's this kind of more nuanced kind of sense that I've been talking about here. Okay, so that in a way, we may be getting back to a point kind of similar to what was happening in the late 19th century when people like Spencer, for example, were thinking about sociology and biology as subjects that were pretty much, didn't have very strong boundary, right? That they were kind of more or less different versions of the same thing. We may be getting back to that kind of viewpoint, okay? But the difference being that when Spencer did it, right, Spencer's view was that we really couldn't intervene very much in this, right? Spencer's way before genetics or let alone biotechnology or anything like that. And so his idea was that if you actually show that there's continuity between the social and the biological, that in a sense meant that a lot of our social behaviors that don't change very easily are in fact natural. Okay. But this is not the lesson that's being taught by the current movement of biology, which is much more a matter of biology being part of your self-identity, being part of what you need to take into account in your decision-making. And it also presupposes you can change things. So to say that something's biological doesn't mean it can't change. Okay, so this is a difference. There's a difference in, and that has to do with the developments that have taken place in the history of biology over the last 100 years or so. Okay, so both of those, so that's an interesting aspect of this whole kind of dynamic in which we're living in with regard to the status of science and society and the way sociology relates to all this. Okay, now, what I want to really talk about today is this business of science wars. And science wars, in a way, one of the things, if you think about what I've been talking about for the last 25 minutes here, what are we seeing? Well, we're seeing that disciplinary boundaries are realigning, right? What had been very clear distinctions between, let's say, sociology and biology, that's disappeared. And there's a more profound thing going on as well, namely, the difference between the natural and the social sciences, which is represented here. Okay, so now the science wars come about largely because, you know, in order to talk about the idea that sociology and biology are in some sense disciplines that relate to each other, that in some sense are talking about common things, right? You have to presume that they're sciences, right? That there's, at some level, sociology and biology have to be comparable. And so then the question becomes, what's a science? We go back to that question. And earlier in this course, I talked about how the professional standing of the scientist, that's something you could train to be,
profession. That idea only comes from the early 19th century. 1831 is when the term scientist is coined as something that one would do as a lifetime profession. Because prior to that point, of course, loads of people pursued science, but typically as an adjunct to other things. It's like almost like a hobby, you might say. But you start to get a profession of scientists that need to be trained in a certain way, 1831. Okay, so the question then comes, you know, what are we identifying science with here? Can you have a science of anything? And the answer, historically speaking, has been yes. You can have a science of anything, and then which means that what makes something a science doesn't have to do with the content, but has to do somehow with the way you study it.
Okay.
And the science wars come about because of this point. Because then you say, well, if to be a science is to study things in a so-called scientific way, then one of the things that we might study in this so-called scientific way is science. Aha. Right? And this is where the problems start. And this is a problem that generally sociologists go on and on at great length about this, most of it quite boring and irrelevant, but sometimes interestingly, and this is the problem of reflexivity. Okay? And I do not suggest you look at the entire literature in this area. Most of it is a waste of time. But it's a very important concept, though. Okay? And it's the idea that, you know, the sorts of things that that you do, right, you apply to yourself. Okay, so we're engaged in the science, okay, we're studying X, well then somebody else can be studying us, scientifically, just like we can study X, right? And you can have everybody studying everybody else. And the sociology of science is basically about that, right? So, you know, part of this, that's what part of this course is about, and part of what we're doing in this room, right, is in a way trying to think scientifically, in some sort of systematic, empirical, testable way about the nature of science itself, just like science, you know, thinks similarly about animals or stars or chemicals or whatever. Okay? And that's the reflexive move. Now, people get very uncomfortable with the reflexive move, right? Because then that's where they're under scrutiny all of a sudden. Okay? And this is where the science wars become a problem. Now, the science wars, in terms of what it refers to, in terms of the period in history, refers to basically from the late 80s, early 90s onward. So science wars are happening even as we speak. Okay, they continue. They're going on. Historically, what it has to do is with the end of the Cold War. And I think I may have mentioned this here, but one of the things that was very distinctive about the Cold War from the standpoint of the sociology of science was that it was during this period that you really see a lot of the institutional structures come into play that we now take for granted as being part of science. Okay? And what I mean by this? Well, it's really for the first time that you have the state as the principal funder of scientific research. Okay? You also have the state providing money for education of scientists, and that includes social scientists as well, in a big way. What you have is this massive centralization taking place. Because prior to the Cold War, with the exception of Germany, it was quite common for science to be pursued in a quite dispersed fashion. Okay? So typically, the only time you would centralize and coordinate scientific activity was in wartime. And so World War I, World War II, you got these periods where the governments would consolidate scientists working in different labs and different universities in order, you know, to fight together. But once the war is over, typically, there was redeployment. Scientists would go back to where they came from, and then you'd sort of go back to normal, basically. But World War II was very different, and after World War II, the consolidation remained. Okay, and so in the United States, you've got this thing, the National Science Foundation, which is really kind of the benchmark institution for what we're talking about here, where you actually have the government becoming the principal shareholder in the development of science. It becomes principal funder of both research, and after the launching of Sputnik in 1957, it gets into the education business. Right, Sputnik being the Soviet space satellite, which basically suggested that the Soviets were going to conquer space before the Americans did, and so the Americans felt that the reason why the Soviets were so far ahead was because they had more people studying science than in the United States, and so therefore there needed to be some financial incentive for students to study science so that all these scholarships and things developed through the government. And the National Science Foundation funneled those things as well. And it's at that time that you get this metaphor, which I've seen used in this country as well, of the pipeline. The pipeline, right? And the idea being that, you know, you got kids studying science, let's say, in the secondary school, high school, right? And the issue is to retain them, right? So they're studying science, and they're doing experiments, and they're all fascinated by it, and some of them are quite good at it. But the problem is, if you look over the course of education, people drop out. Right, relatively few of these people who are so animated by science in the secondary school end up going through to get PhDs in the subject. So they kind of like the pipeline is leaky, you might say, right? So the people are spilling out in various places. So then the issue is going to be, how do you keep them in? And now this is an issue that we see today, right? People always talking about this problem. And it's interesting because, of course, nowadays, part of the problem is diagnosed, for example, in gender terms, right? Because as you know, women outperform men at the secondary school level very easily, okay, and even in science. But something happens down the road by the time you get to a PhD, and then most of the women drop out. And so there's the issue of gender discrimination along the way that takes place, right? And there's a reason to believe this. Okay, so then women fall out of the pipeline in that sense. Well, this whole way of thinking about science, that there is this kind of consolidated research base and education base, right, goes back to the Cold War. Because science was going to be the way in which the Cold War was going to be won. Because most of the Cold War was about second-guessing what the opponent was going to do. U.S., USSR, you know, intelligence, counterintelligence, you know, radars. You know, you think about all the stuff that kind of came in with the Cold War. And that all of this is very high-tech, very super sophisticated. There weren't that many wars actually fought, right? It was rather this kind of second-guessing that involved a lot of long-term strategizing using science. So all these scientists were brought in to bear. But then the Cold War is over, right? 1989 happens. Berlin Wall falls down. Soviet Union falls apart. All these things happen very quickly. And most of the Western countries, and this is also true of Russia, right, are in these enormous budget deficits. And so all of a sudden, everything has got to be justified from scratch. So if there is no more national security threat, the taken-for-granted role of science disappears. So then the question becomes, why do we fund science? So this opens the question in a very kind of foundational way about what the point of science in society is once we take the national security issue off the table. And this is when the science wars start, okay? Because by 1989, let's say, you already have in existence about 15 years of people who are working in the sociology of science. Not very, you know, these people are doing their thing. They're not getting, like, you know, media attention or anything, but they're doing their thing and they're known. And one of the things that is very obvious from the sociology of science is that if you study scientists scientifically, that is to say, to observe their practices in the laboratory and so forth, that in fact, scientists, strangely enough, are like ordinary human beings. How about that? And in particular, that you can explain their behavior by using the normal kinds of concepts, categories, theories, whatever, that you would normally use to explain the behavior of non-scientific people in similar circumstances. So for example, you got to imagine a lab, right? So a lab has a lot of people working in it. It's like a little mini factory in a way. You've got people running the show. You've got people on the ground doing the hard work of mixing the chemicals in the test tubes, Right, so you've got like a little factory going on with a kind of chain of command, like a little, you know, industrial labor force thing happening there. And in fact, labs are organized historically based on factory organization. There's also a historical connection there, so it's not just arbitrary, right, that labs are organized like factories. Okay, and the relationships between people are factory-like. So if you do a course in labor sociology, right, that in a sense, you can start getting some insight into how labs work. And that's part of what sociology of science was doing back in the 70s and 80s, okay? Then the question becomes, well, wait a minute, guys. These people aren't just making cars or something. These people are like discovering the structure of DNA or something really massively significant. It's not just consumer goods here. This is basic research we're talking about. So doesn't the theory, doesn't the conceptualization behind the work they're doing in the lab, doesn't that matter? And the answer is, to make a long story short, no. Okay, and this is the controversial part, right? Namely, that sociology of science has consistently concluded since the 70s, that basically the kinds of things that we typically think of as being distinctive about scientific activity, so the fact that it's going after the truth, that it has a kind of objective view of the world, that it's especially rational, more rational than other sorts of social activities we're engaged in, that the primary evidence for that is linguistic. In other words, this is the talk. People talk the talk, but do they walk the walk? Okay, and the question is the difference between the talk and the walk in science. And this is one thing the sociologists of science come up with. Namely, yes, there is all this talk out there about, you know, we're discovering the underlying structures of reality and all the rest of it. That's how we justify what we're doing in these labs. No doubt about it. It appears in the journal articles. It appears in the press releases. It appears in the ordinary talk, you know, of people when they're talking about science publicly. But does that explain what they're doing in the lab? Does that actually explain their work? Does that actually explain their practices? And the answer is no. So in a way, the status of this talk that we consider to be so emblematic of science is a kind of, you might say, rationalization. Right? It's made for export. Right? The talk is made for what you do, you know, it's made for what happens outside the lab. Now, how do you do this? Well, you know, you do sociology science. One of the things you do, and you think about it, some of you have taken some research methods courses, right? And you do a little bit of, you know, you've got interviewing and the ethnography, and that's kind of what a lot of these guys do. And so they're going into labs, and sometimes in order, they do a participant observation thing. That's to say they get themselves hired as test tube cleaners or something, right? So they get in there and kind of act as if they're sort of an employee of the lab in a sort of technician mode, right? Minor. So they're mixing with people, right? They're sort of seeing what's happening and talking to them and overhearing conversations. And they record all this stuff, as you do when you're doing the ethnography, right? And then you look at the transcript of what it is these people have been saying and what they've been telling you when you talk to them. And you find out that there's not a whole lot of technical stuff going on there at all. It's all the grunts and groans of everyday life. These people in the lab, when they're talking about this supposedly very sophisticated science, they're talking about it as if they were making cars, right? So all the discussion is about whether you got the mix of the chemicals right, whether the meter is running right, you know, what are you having for lunch? You know, I mean, the kind of stuff that people normally talk about in these industrial settings, right? There is no marked greater sophistication going on. Now, when you move to the seminar room or the writing place where these people have to start to justify their activities for a larger audience, oh, well, then the story changes. Then all of a sudden people are very self-consciously thinking about how we describe what's been happening here. Right? Which experiments do we count? Right? How do we interpret this data? Okay? And then you enter into an entirely different mode of discourse. Right? Because, you know, and it's like, you know, how do we package this? How do we spin this? I mean, if you're in politics, that's what you would say, right? I mean, that would be the way to put it. We don't say it that way in science. That sounds very crude. But that's kind of what goes on when you're writing, you know, an article for a scientific journal based on research. You've got this research going on in the lab, involves 10, 15 technicians and professors and whatever. They're doing a whole mess of things. A lot of it is very complicated. Staff changes during the period, all the rest of it, because a lot of people are on short-term contracts, working on multiple projects, confusion everywhere, blah, blah, blah. That's normal. That's normal in any kind of business. But then you get into the room where you got to write up the article, and everything has to become crystal clear. Everything has to become completely rational. It has to look like, you know, one of these, you know, papers you see in Science or Nature, where it's all laid out with a literature, you know, just like you have to write your theses, right? The literature review and, you know, thesis and method, data and conclusions and brilliance, you know, and it's all laid out in some logical fashion. But in fact, that's not how the thing happens at all, right? That isn't the thing the sociology of science discovered. And, you know, in a lot of the early works that were published in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, you read these books, you know, you would see that they would actually reproduce transcripts of conversations about certain things happening in the lab, and then next to it, you would see what the written up version looked like for the journal, which looks spanking clean and brilliant, but then you see what they were talking about in the lab, and oh man, I mean, I don't think we can use that sample, I don't think we can do this. Right, so you tossed out half your data, but never mentioned you did that. Right, this is normal stuff. Right, now, okay, so all this stuff is being produced in the sociology of science. It's interesting stuff. It has virtually no impact on anything until the end of the 1980s. Why? Because people up to that point already believed that science was a very important thing to have around because of national security reasons. So they didn't start asking any kind of deeper questions about, well, how do the practices of science relate to the conclusions the scientists draw, blah, blah, blah. They didn't ask any of those deep questions. But then when the Cold War was over, then the questions get open from scratch, and you say, well, why are we supporting science anyway? These scientists are claiming they can do this, that, and the other thing. But how do we know this? And then all of a sudden they start reading some sociology. You know, and I'm talking about like people in Congress, policymakers who control the purse strings. They start, you know, maybe they themselves don't read it, but they have staffers and others who read it, right? And they read, and these staffers are saying, well, you know, I've just been reading, you know, this, you know, Bruno Latour or somebody like this, and these people are saying that science is pretty ordinary stuff, so I really think that, you know, scientists need to account for themselves a little bit more explicitly. We just can't give a blank check anymore. I mean, because after all, it's not like scientists are asking for peanuts, right? Scientists are asking for loads and loads of money. And if the way they work is really no different from how other workers work, then what are we paying them for? Okay, so this kind of issues. So, now scientists are not to believe by this. And this is where we get the science wars, right? Because scientists are just not pleased by this at all. Okay, because it being as a thing, and I think maybe rightly, demystifies, right? Scientists are being demystified. Because the sociology of science looks like it is presenting the scientific discourse of rationality, objectivity, truth, all that kind of stuff, as, you know, what Marx would call false consciousness, right? These scientists are pumping up all this gas, right, that doesn't really adequately capture what they're doing, but mystifies people so they believe, continue supporting them, and so forth. That is the rather negative spin that scientists read in what the sociology of science does, and that's what creates the science wars, is this kind of problem. And there was a really concrete case where this really did matter. 1992, you may know that the United States, you know, there are all these particle accelerators around the world, and they're trying to find out the fundamental units of matter, okay? And what they do is they take some, you know, subatomic particles and they smash them against each other at incredible speeds, right? And they're trying to reproduce the Big Bang. That's what you're trying to get, a machine that's going to reproduce the energy that was involved in the Big Bang, okay? Now, obviously, this machine is going to have to be moving these particles pretty fast, so you pretty much need a very big machine to get the momentum going so those particles can move around. As you know, there's this the European Particle Accelerator, CERN, in Switzerland, and if you actually look at that sucker, the whole thing covers, you know, like three countries or so. something in terms, it's very large. Well, the Americans were trying to build something like this in Texas. Big state, lots of room, right? 52 miles underground, I mean, it was a 52 mile radius underground. Enormous thing. It would have been the biggest in the world. The superconducting supercollider, it was called. And Congress approved of it in the late 1980s, so it was approved. It was approved under George Bush's father. But as with all these funding projects in Congress, which had like a $10 billion price tag in late 1980s, you fund it on a year-to-year basis based on what it's doing. And it had cost overruns, as all these things inevitably did. All right. And then in the meanwhile, massive budget deficit, end of the Cold War, and some of the staffers in Congress read this science study stuff. And even though several Nobel Prize winners in physics testified before Congress saying how important this thing was going to be, we're finally going to get the ultimate properties of matter, blah, 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 that we've been trying to get after 2,000 years and all the rest of it, Congress ended up voting it down in 1992, ending it, after it had spent, I think, a billion or two, saying we're closing this shop down. Because it couldn't properly justify itself. Congress had raised the bar, basically, on how you justify scientific research given the amount of money that was to be invested publicly. Now, in the aftermath of this, there are a lot of ways to go. One can say, well, nations ought to cooperate more with each other. Like, why do you need competing particle accelerators? Why can't everybody just work on one? Right? I mean, there are those kinds of answers. So it's not like it's not like the physics research based on particle accelerators has disappeared. No, but people are working more cooperatively together. Some members of Congress also suggested, and this is the interesting point, that if this stuff is really so important, somebody in the private sector will pick it up. You know that argument, right? If something really matters, why does the government have to fund it? Doesn't the government just fund losing propositions, not stuff that can really support themselves? And now this argument gets applied to science. Now that's interesting, right? Because what that does is it kind of makes science look like something like consumer goods, right? In other words, that the way you justify the pursuit of science is by whatever immediate benefit it can provide for those funding it. Now that's a very unusual ground for funding science. Now and so not surprisingly, what you end up seeing happening over the last 20 years, since the end of the Cold War, is this gradual shift in funding from physics to biology. Why? Because think about what biological research is all about. Biomedicine, okay? Pharmaceuticals, all this biotechnology and enhancement and stuff like that. In other words, this is the pursuit of science, right, that is much closer to the consumer in the sense that you can kind of imagine much more clearly what the benefit to you would be in putting some money into this. Okay? Now, you might say, oh, this is great. Now we're funding science because it's useful, it's relevant. Whereas all this old physics stuff was just about particles that, only few elite physicists cared about. Well, it's not so simple, of course, because when it comes to funding science these days, the only people who matter are the ones with the money. Okay? So while there is, more than ever, money available for biomedical research, development of new pharmaceuticals, and enhancements and so forth, the various conditions and diseases and problems that are targeted are the ones that are actually most consumer-friendly. That is to say, rich people are interested in. Okay. So for example, all this delay that's been going on in production of cheap drugs to cure persistent diseases of epidemic proportion in the third world, okay, why are the companies dragging their heels on this point? Whereas they're spending a lot of money in very sort of top-of-the-line stuff that might only cure relatively few people. Okay, why is that? Well, that's the market. Okay, that's what happens when you have science immediately open to the market. that certain areas of science will develop tremendously as they get drawn toward the consumer, but other areas for which there is no obvious consumer group, especially, and by consumer group, I mean paying consumer group. Yes, there are millions of people starving in Africa, but they don't have any money. So who cares about them? Right? So it's not just having a potential market, but an actual market with people, with money. So science is now being dragged in that kind of direction. So for example, it is amazing, I mean, I find this personally amazing, that we do spend so much time and energy, if you look at a lot of the discussion about what the future of science is going, on this enhancement, transhuman, post-human stuff. Okay? Because this is really just, this is a kind of a fantasy issue for people who already plan to live a long time in a normal state and then want to go the next step beyond. But what percentage of the world is in that situation? Right? Where they can be guaranteed to live a pretty normal, healthy life until, let's say, the age of 80, 85. Because those are the people who really find the enhancement stuff fascinating. Because they say, well, maybe I can boost my brain so I can live to be like 95. Right? Well, how about getting people to 60? You see? And then not so much excitement about that. All right. And so this is one of the situations where, and this is one of the consequences of the science wars. Now you see a lot of publicly minded scientists, you know, scientists who believe that science should be the people and for the people and so forth, don't like the sociology of science because the sociology of science, in a sense, opened the door to this kind of market perspective by demystifying science. Okay? Because once you demystify science's, you know, specifically truth, rationality, objectivity, orientation, then you can get the policymakers to ask, well, what makes science so special? And if you're asking the state to provide a lot of money, you've got to show what you're going to do. And if you can't show us at the state level, then you go to the marketplace and you sell your goods there and see who buys them. And see, once you follow that logic, right, you're going to end up getting this very consumer-driven sort of science that will be increasingly pushing things toward the high end of the market, with most of the population kind of left behind or in some sort of, you know, deprived state. And so for this reason, the ideological side of the science wars is very fascinating because the sociologists of science think of themselves as being very liberal, kind of left-wing people who are against the authority of science, you know, where people, you know, scientists can kind of be very authoritarian with their objectivity and truth and say, we know stuff you don't know, kind of thing. And so sociology of science cuts that down, but it then opens the door to this other thing, this marketization thing, right, whereby science just becomes this consumer good. Okay. And so a lot of scientists who think of themselves as being on the left, as being progressive, don't like this either. Okay, so it's a very mixed legacy, the science wars. And the sociology of science in this field, the field that's become, I talk about it in the knowledge book as a science and technology studies, because it's more than just sociology now. It involves historians, philosophers, and a whole bunch of other people. But the field is now called science and technology studies. They're the ones that, in a sense, are at the center of the controversy surrounding the science wars. And next time, I'm going to sort of talk about this, bring this in a sort of more general way, because this development that we've got with science, where it's kind of been thrown into the marketplace and no longer has a sort of clear, unified identity, is very much part of sort of a general trend in culture in the post-war era, post-World War II era, so-called postmodernism, right? Postmodernism. And we'll talk more about that, because this is an example. What I've been talking about today is an example of postmodernism. And we'll talk more about that in the next class.